Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Yvonne Smith, your host of Late Night with the Hero. And tonight we have Joseph Rogers, who is the Chief Advocacy Officer for the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, which he was president from 1997 to 2007. I know some of the listeners may have be familiar with Mr. Rogers as being also at one time head of the Mental Health Clearinghouse and a fixture at our annual Alternatives Conference. Joseph, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Okay. Now, I want to thank you again for agreeing to do this. I know that you guys are very busy with grant applications and things, and so I know that you won't be able to stay with us the entire time. For those who are listening, if you wish to call in, you can call in on 267-521-0167. Again, if you want to call in, you can call in on 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, you can call in on 855-346-3351. If you wish to call in and you want to ask a question or comment, please press 1 or star 1 on your phone. That's how I will know that you desire to be let in on the phone. Now, Joseph, the reason why I wanted to have you on the show is because I know there's been a lot of talk about several things that I know that you could help clear up for us. You did recently did a radio show on with another person in the Philadelphia area about possibly the bioethicist return to using asylums, and we're very much interested also in the things that are happening with the Murphy Bill. And you yourself, you were in a mental health hospital for some time. Is that correct?
Yes, I was. Yep, been hospitalized. Mm. Mm-hmm.
How long were you hospitalized?
Well, I spent about 6 months I've been in and out of different hospitals, but this was a state-run facility, and I was there for about 6 months. And then I've been in other hospitals for a month at a time, and things like that. So I've probably been hospitalized a total of maybe a year, if you add them all up.
Well, a year is a long time. But anyway, you have enough experience. You are that you've been there for a year is quite a long length of time for somebody to be in the hospital compared to today's standards. When you first heard that that people were talking about returning to lots of inpatient as an intervention, what did you think about that? I know that some other people, treatment before tragedy people, some other people have been, very much saying that we just don't have enough beds.
Well, this question's not a new question. I think that I've heard of discussions of the lack of psychiatric beds, even when we had three state hospitals, which probably had a total of 2,000 or 3,000 hospital beds amongst the three of them. And even back then, they were saying, "Well, we need more beds." And Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania has a lot of psychiatric beds, a lot less now. We closed down two state hospitals, and our organization, the Mental Health Association, was very instrumental in the advocacy to close down Philadelphia State Hospital, Haverford State Hospital. So I feel that it's not a matter of beds. Beds are only a very temporary solution, and they're not a very good solution. When somebody's in crisis, hospitalizing a person, or ending up in the hospital, as I have ended up in the hospital, we talked about, I ended up in the hospital, is at the best a very temporary solution. and usually is really a demonstration of where the system has failed, where things have just not really, the interventions, the help has just not been there for people, so that they end up in that level of crisis where they end up in a psychiatric bed. So I'm much more of an advocate for looking for alternatives to hospitalization. I think that for the most part, people can and should receive support and help as you know, close to their home as possible, if not in their home. And I think we've demonstrated that with a lot of good research, that that's really possible, that most people, situation, crisis, whatever you want to call it, can be handled pretty close to home, and that putting somebody in the hospital actually puts them at risk, especially if you're talking about things like state hospitals. State hospitals, you're putting a person at risk of, because it just the mechanism of state hospitals, for the most part, aren't very acute. They usually, you're talking about hospital stays 3-4 months, and when you put somebody in a hospital for 3 or 4 months, the risk is that they'll become more dependent and more likely to not, you know, do the things that are needed to live successfully in the community. And you take a person out of their home, take them out of their apartment. I've seen people lose their apartments, lose their housing, end up going into a hospital. They can't live in the hospital and pay rent and things like that, so they lose their house. And then after the hospitalization's over, what happens then? They've got to start over. They don't have a place to live. They may even, I've seen situation where people have lost their pets, people have lost their children, have been taken away from them. So it's pretty drastic when you hospitalize people, especially when you're hospitalizing them against their will. And I want to see us do everything we can to avoid that, and definitely not increase the amount of hospitalization.
Yes, Joseph, I agree with that too. I think that 3 months, that's for where I live, that's a short stay. We still have people here at St. Elizabeth's, that's the state hospital, that have been 2 years, 3 years, 20 years, 30 years. Something like the median years is like 5 years. And these are not all patients that are forensic. I think that the hospitalization actually does damage. And I was hospitalized too, for a short period of time. But I think that, as you said, people lose how to be able to function. They become, you didn't use these words, they become institutionalized. And it's a bigger hole. We have to do more work, even in peer support, when you have someone who's in the hospital for such a long time. And it just seems as though with the, I call it the chronic movement, the movement to say that there's a special case of people that are so chronic that they need this special intervention where they're constantly watched, even to the point of saying that if a person has a label and they came out of prison, I think that this is the reason why some people want to, they say that, well, no, prison is not the answer. Let's have them in a hospital, but I don't know in Pennsylvania. But here, I know most of the people that I know that are in our state hospital, and I'm on one of several of the patient committees. And when I say patient, I mean people that live in the hospital. I mean, their stays are very long. Some of them for petty crimes, like some of the forensic, like for stealing a necklace or something. And I said, that's kind of like people, when I say that, it's kind of ghoulish to think somebody's being treated as if they were somewhere in another country. And I think that, as I agree, we don't have enough things to help people get over that institutionalization.
Well, what I find is that what we have found here in Philadelphia area and in Pennsylvania is that we've been able to close down our state hospitals. We're down. We had, like I said in the beginning, when I first moved here in 1984, we had 3 state hospitals. And one of the things I wanted to see in my advocacy work is what we could do to move away from using state hospitals. Not only were they using state hospitals, it was about 80% of the funding went to the state hospitals, and only about 20% of the funding went to the community. We've been able to change that around now, where it's about 20% of the funding from the state goes into state hospitals, and 80% of the funding goes to the community. So we wanted to change not only where people were at, but where the resources were at, so that people could get resources to live successfully in the community. And people need support. I'm not one who doesn't feel that people need supports, and some people need lots of support. I mean, there are people that mostly because of
lots of support is cheaper than what it is. I know a hospital stay at St. Elizabeth, I don't know what it is, but in Pennsylvania, the home state of Tim Murphy, here it's over $200,000. I could have round-the-clock nurses in my apartment.
Right.
It
runs around that, too. Yeah, well, people can live in the community, and the supports can be, even if they're intensive supports, can be more cost-effective. So that's what we started to do. We started to organize and advocate for a real look at what it was that was happening. And one of the things we found, there was a huge amount of abuse and neglect when it came to our state hospitals. People were not treated well. I mean, that's one of the things when they talk about this concept of asylum, is they're talking about a fantasy place that doesn't exist and has never existed. Somehow we're going to change the way we've done things for the last two or three centuries and start treating people with dignity. When even up into this century, we're still treating people terribly when it comes to the treatment they get in not just state hospitals, but in regular community hospitals. Some of the horror stories we hear at the Mental Health Association are really bad.
You can't have. I think it's kind of inherent. Anytime you any other place, no one else goes to the hospital because they're having a heart bypass and they lock the doors. That you're
right.
Locked in. No one else goes to a place where they have barbed wire. I think that. They won't, even if they have smaller, one of the provisions in the, people are calling the Murphy Bill, but it has to be resubmitted, and it might not be in the form that it's in now. One of those provisions was for the IMD exclusion. And I don't even think if you have smaller ones. I was on a, I was in a smaller ward on a in a private hospital. And I think that it doesn't matter if the aesthetics of the place, if they got good furniture, I think it doesn't matter because you're still locked up. And the people who are there, who are supposed to be there to help, I use the word stabilize people on chemicals because that's really all that they can do in the hospital. It really doesn't help you with recovery, is to do that. I think that they can't help but become monsters themselves.
Yeah, what you said, the size is not that even that material. I think that even 16, 17, 18 bed units, which under the IMD, which was Institutions for Mental Disease, which is a rule that the federal government has. They don't want medical dollars being spent. It was established back in the days when states wanted to not spend money on state hospitals, and they would have liked to spend federal dollars to replace state dollars. And there was an effort to stop that because they didn't want the federal government to become the funding source for state hospitals. The idea was to downsize and get rid of state hospitals and not just replace the funding with federal government funding when they created the Medicaid program. And so they established a rule, a regulation, a law that requires that anything over a 16-bed facility is an institution for mental disease, and it's against the law to use the Medicaid dollars. So, but you know, so they say now, well, we want 20-bed units. They want to change the IMD under the Murphy Law to where it would be, you know, something under, I forget the numbers, but it's still smaller. It's not, they'll say, well, we won't build state hospitals, we won't build multi-100-bed hospitals, but they'll be 20-bed or 25 or 30. I'm not sure, I don't remember. But even that level of institutionalization creates problems for people, because you put people, you know, when people are having troubles and struggling, the last thing you need to do is sort of pile it on and have more people with struggles and troubles in one place. What we found is a model here. It's called Housing First model, where we work with resources that we have. Instead of using them for inpatient facilities, we create housing where a person gets their own place to live, their own apartment. And that's the first thing we try to do, is get them the housing, even if they're in so-called crisis, even if they're homeless, even if they're still struggling, even if they're using drugs. We help them get housing, and then we build the structure, the supports around whatever structures they need and supports they need, so they can stay successfully in the housing. And we find that model really works very well.
Well, let me just see. I think I have some callers. You can call in again, and if you will press *1 or 1, we can let you in. I see we have caller 718, and 718 area code, or 970 area code. If you want to come in, the lines are open now. If you have comment or question, you may come in, or if you could use Twitter or Facebook, at YZ Smith, if you have question or comment. I have phone lines open now.
Yeah. They just need to push 1. Is that what it is?
It's press 1 or either *1. Either. It depends on whether you're on a cell phone or on a landline phone.
Right.
But, you know, Tim Murphy said 3 weeks ago when I heard him at his luncheon that was to give him an award from the Treatment Advocacy Center, he said that Housing First was ridiculous. And he constantly says that that we should be going with evidence-based practices. But I think some of the things like Housing First are evidence-based.
Oh, there's been a lot of research on Housing First. Started in New York City and was pretty extensively researched. I'm not a researcher, so I don't have it at my fingertip. Maybe one of the callers calling in could talk to us about it. But it was researched first in New York City, and it's spread to several cities, including Philadelphia, and continues to be researched and evaluated. And just from my own personal experience with Housing First, I've seen it have a huge effect. When we targeted in Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia started our Housing First program with an emphasis on helping people with long-term homeless issues, people that have been homeless or living in shelters and living on the streets even for long periods of time, were the targeted population. So you'd say, well, those are probably people with a lot of challenges because, you know, they've been homeless for so long. But, and you know, if you have a model, one of the things that Representative Murphy states is that we don't model our programs for the most seriously challenged, as he would call it, the seriously chronically mentally ill, as he would say. And that's the term that they use. And what we found is that
there is no
category.
There's no category. I don't know. The DSM, the Bible is so big. I'm not going to profess that I know everything that's in it. But from what I understand, there is no. They have no diagnosis that says
right.
seriously mentally ill.
Right.
I don't know how would you.
Well, they
I mean,
use those terms.
That,
yeah, well, that's a whole other matter. We could talk about that. But right now, just in terms of that's what they're saying, and I agree with you. I think that they're making terms up, making ideas up. But in say go with it, that there's some validity that there are people that, for example, that have been homeless for a long time. They've lived on the streets. Well, you would think that would be a population of folks that would be very hard and challenging. And we found that even those folks do extremely well in the housing first model, and there's research to demonstrate that. Yeah, I think it's interesting when you look at the what I would call propaganda coming out of Senator Murphy, who, like you said, is from Pennsylvania, from Western Pennsylvania.
You're voting him for senator. He's a congressman.
Congressman, I'm sorry.
He's a congressman.
There actually is a Senator Murphy, and he's actually a pretty good guy. So Congressman Murphy, yes, you're right. Congressman Timothy Murphy from Western Pennsylvania, not from our area, but from Western Pennsylvania. He in his kind of propaganda machine, as you said, have talked about this sort of population that doesn't seem to really, really exist of people who aren't responsive to any. It's a sort of an interesting contradiction when you think about it, though. They say, well, what we need to do is create a program. We need a new program, or we need to expand the availability of a program, which they call which I call involuntary outpatient commitment, which they call assisted outpatient treatment. Okay, so this is a new program that they've created. And supposedly, because you have a judge telling the person to take their medication, or a judge telling the person to go see a therapist or whatever the outpatient orders are, that makes a difference. That somehow is going to make a difference for people that are supposedly so out of it, you know, make it colloquial.
I don't even think that's not responsive. If he says housing first is ridiculous, I've never known any pill or any treatment that have helped people be housed. So, you know,
right.
Some people
that's my point.
Say that this
is that's sort of somehow, you know, making a judge order something will make it happen. That instead of just providing it, we now create a whole nother layer, which is oppressive for people, of a judge sort of ordering it. Well, if a judge can order it, if it exists, we don't need a judge ordering it. Why not just provide it? If a person needs housing, why not just provide the housing? Why make them go through the hoops
of
being ordered into housing?
He said that's ridiculous. You know, these people need treatment before tragedy. That's their mantra. But I don't know if you're it's cold outside now, and any number of people in Washington, D.C. that are homeless, I don't know of any pill or anything that's going to help them suddenly become functional to become. And some people have the idea that everybody out there has some kind of emotional distress. But, of course, if I was on the street for most of the year, I'd be in emotional distress, too. But I can't see it, and this is the same person who is against affordable health care. And I don't understand
right.
why people buy into it. That, you know,
right.
man doesn't want everybody, he doesn't want insurance for the very vulnerable. Now there's another proposal that he has. He put out a 7-page paper where he wants care to be available to not just to people middle and working class. They want to be available to upper classes, and this is going to be a part of his new bill that he's having. But another thing that I wanted to bring up is people somehow think that they cannot educate or advocate their legislators on what the realities are and what this and other legislation. And I know that you've been an activist as well as a CEO of one of the larger mental health agencies in Pennsylvania. What is the truth? What is it that people feel as though, well, they say, Yvonne, we can't do that. We're 501c3 or we're agency. What is the handicap that they're having?
Well, the reality is anyone, you know, we're all citizens, and we as citizens have not only a right, but we have an obligation to talk to our people that represent us, the senators, the congressmen, state legislators, mayor, city council person. I mean, under what people worry about is mostly what's called IRS regulation, Internal Revenue Service regulations. To qualify as a non-for-profit corporation under the IRS regulations, you can't be a partisan. You can't be a partisan organization. You can't support a candidate for office. You can't say you're a Democrat or Republican organization. You have to be nonpartisan. And when it comes to legislation, you can't do most of your business can't be influencing legislation, but a certain percentage, and it's a very vague kind of regulation, but something like 10-15% of your resources can go towards working on legislative issues. So, people, even if they're doing it as part of a nonprofit corporation, can get involved in some of these issues. And what we've done in Pennsylvania is we've established relationships with legislators so that they come and ask us. We go and tell them stories. It's kind of easy. You go, most politicians are quite comfortable with people. That's what they do for a living, is meet and greet and talk to people. So they're very comfortable. So you go and set up an appointment to go talk to your local legislator, to your state legislator, or your congressman, your senator. They're ready for you. They know that you're a citizen with issues, and they know that you're coming in there to tell them about it. And what I do is I go and tell them stories. I tell them about some of the people that we work with and what happens in their lives and what some of their needs are. And it's good if you can do it several times over a year, because then you establish a relationship. And what we've found is once you establish that relationship, they come and ask you questions. And it's unlimited how many questions you can answer. If a legislator calls you up and asks you a question, as a nonprofit, you're providing an education. You're not lobbying at that point. You're responding to a question from a legislator, and you almost have an obligation to do that. So there's a lot of wiggle room and outright freedom to talk to your legislators. In fact, we do it on a regular basis. We have an annual Capitol Hill Day. We do things like take busloads of people. One of the things that I say, if you're a nonprofit and you're concerned about talking to legislators, don't you talk to the legislators. Have the people that use your service talk to your legislators. So if you're a consumer-run center and you don't want your staff necessarily, people saying, well, you're partisan, you're talking about legislation, well, then, the people that use your services, make sure that they're registered to vote. That's nonpartisan activity, to register people to vote. And letting them know who their legislators are, having letter-writing campaigns, presenting the issues. You can present issues in such a way that you're not taking a partisan position. For example, the Murphy Bill. You can just educate people that there is such a piece of legislation, and here are the things the legislation is calling for. And, you can take a position. You're allowed to take a position. But if you want to be even more neutral than that, I trust the people. I trust people to really look at something like the Murphy Bill and say, well,
people are allowed position. People can take a position.
They can, but if you're concerned about taking positions for whatever reason, maybe you're concerned that your donors or your funding source will say, we don't want you taking positions, which is not, is really illegal, but, people have those concerns. You can still educate people about legislation. You can tell them, here is a piece of legislation being proposed. Here's a piece of legislation that would eliminate protection and advocacy services. here's a piece of legislation that would eliminate your rights as for HIPAA protection. And that's the truth. That's the fact. That's not taking a position. That's simply telling them what the legislation would do. And I trust that people, once they're told that their rights are going to be eliminated and an agency that protects their rights is going to be eliminated by a piece of legislation, they'll take it from there, you know, especially if you've educated them on advocacy. You can educate a person around how to be an advocate without necessarily taking any position on any issue. You can simply talk to people about how to write a letter, how to visit a legislator. And we do that a lot, even though we take a position because we feel that we have a right to do that. But, you know, even if you're an organization that doesn't want to be too political, you know, they're afraid that, you know, they'll be seen as being very political, you can still do a lot to educate people on the issues.
Okay. I have are there other people on the line from other area codes? I just want people to know the lines are open if they want to. 310 is the area code, and 315, if you wish to come on, the lines are open if you wish to ask a question or make a comment. You mentioned the PNA and the HIPAA, and that is two of the provisions of the last legislative session's Murphy bill that was there. I was really surprised when people are not really knowledgeable about HIPAA, and it just seems as though right now with HIPAA, if I want my mother or even a friend to be able to talk to my doctor, I can just sign off and say that.
Yes.
So there's nothing. Or even if I was living with somebody and there was a reason for it, there is provision now. And I think many people don't understand it. If all you want to do is to talk to someone's health care provider, you can do that now. Now they can't give you information without without the individual's consent. But I don't understand what the people that want to have the HIPAA laws thrown out. I don't understand.
Well,
the
HIPAA laws came about, it's interesting, the history of the HIPAA laws. HIPAA laws came about because for purposes of funding and cost containment, the federal government wanted to create it ease of access to medical records. They wanted to make it easier for people to communicate around medical records. They wanted coordination of services, for example, so that there would be the ability for one doctor, if you're going to see an optometrist, your optometrist can talk to your, you know, podiatrist, and, you know, to the degree that your podiatrist needs to talk to your optometrist, they can talk to each other. And what HIPAA does is establish the rules of the road, so to speak. It says, well, if the podiatrist wants to talk to the optometrist, they need to get a written release of information. So when I come in to see my podiatrist presents me with a piece of paper that says, I want to be able to talk to your optometrist, you know, or I want to talk to your general practitioner. And then it's up to me. I can say, well, I don't want to sign that. I don't want you talking to my GP. It's none of his business what I'm doing with my podiatrist. And so that's my right to refuse that communication. Now, it's also the doctor's right to say, well, then I don't want to treat you. So, you know, it's sort of an interesting thing. If you don't give them permission to share the information, they can also say, well, I'm not interested in treating you because I feel I need to be able to talk to a general practitioner because something might happen medically and I need to consult with your doctor. But it that's all HIPAA was establishing regulation so that people can have these practical communication amongst each other. And it's based on constitutional law, right to privacy, and you know, lots of decisions that the federal courts have made over the years around one's right to privacy. It's just like, if somebody can't share your credit information without your written permission. So that's all the HIPAA law is. It's a right to establish your right to privacy and establishes the rules on how people can share information about you. What are the regulations? And what Murphy wants to do is throw that all out and say, well, when it comes to a mental health diagnosis, you don't get any protection. You know, there are no rules. The doctor can talk to whoever they want, basically. Somebody can call up and say, I'm your mother, and, that's enough. Well, that's no protection at all. And so we definitely have to fight that because, I as a citizen just would like my rights protected. I don't want my rights signed away just because I have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which is my diagnosis, mental illness. Diagnosis is bipolar disorder. Just because I have that diagnosis, I don't want my rights taken away from me.
Well, in my case, it's been kind of good because here in the last few years, I'm almost totally all off of medication, and it's really because my doctors have been talking to each other. I have sleep.
One station,
Sounds like somebody's on the phone.
Who's there? Yeah. Your line is open. You have a comment? They may not be aware that I opened up the lines. I have sleep apnea, and now they've given me super duper vitamin D. I'm going to close this off because there's some talk. People, if you wish to make a comment, if you press 1 or star 1, I can reopen the lines up. I found that vitamin D was very helpful, and it's all this stuff is only because all of these disciplines were able to see records. They were able to see my levels, and I think it's a bad thing on my part to say I took all of these different medications for. At least I took some when I was a child up until I was like a young adult. But for the last 20 years, and some of them have caused big problems. And the reason why I'm getting, symptom-free is because they've found these other medical conditions that they're taking care of. So I think it's a good thing. And many people don't realize that the HIPAA law also makes it so you can get access to your own records.
Well, that's
the
thing.
Many people don't
ultimately
realize there's a civil rights division. Go ahead.
I think ultimately the solution is some with some technology because I have an app on my phone that allows me to enter any data I want about my healthcare record. So I can put in my medications that I'm on. I can put in my pharmacy phone number. I can put in my doctors, what their names are, what their phone numbers are. If I want to talk about my diabetes, I can talk a little bit about my diabetes and how I'm treating my diabetes. So I can create with this app all the information, my own little database, or not so little database, about my treatment. And one of the things I can do is I can assign it to anyone I want to can have access to that data. So if my wife, for example, I would like my wife to know what my medications are in case I end up in the emergency room, God forbid, my wife can access it. She has access. She has the app is on her phone, and she can, she has all the passwords and everything. So if she needs to access my medical information, because as my guardian, as the person who, if I was unconscious or not able to, make decisions, who would be the one I'd want to make decisions for me, or at least be able to talk to the doctors and inform the doctors, she has that ability. So I think with technology we can solve some of this problem because if you want your family members, I think part of the problem is a lot of times providers they use HIPAA as an excuse not to talk to family members, when maybe the person would be perfectly happy to have the family members involved. In fact, most people I know, you know, if they trust their family members, if the family member, somebody that's involved in their life, they generally want the family members involved. And I think a lot of times providers just find it complicated or whatever to also have to talk to family members. So they'll say, oh, well, the HIPAA prevents me from talking to you. Well, HIPAA doesn't prevent me from talking from a provider from talking to somebody. HIPAA says, here's the procedures that you need to follow for somebody to talk to. Talk to somebody other than the person who's receiving the care. So I think it's kind of a false issue that, you know, some family members who, for whatever reason, their loved one doesn't want them involved in their care. And there are definitely people in my situation, in my life, that I didn't want involved and being told and informed. If I was in the hospital, I didn't want them to know I was in the hospital. And I think I have a right to you know, make those choices.
Yeah, I think everyone has that. I mean, if you're being abused by someone, you know, that would be a good reason for you not to. Even if it's not a good reason, you know, just, you know, people would have no reason to do that. Yeah, because sometimes what happens is people get together, and they, I've known people who have been in our state hospital wherein the real reason that they're there is because when they came there, they were a minor. And it's really, really very harsh when you've got people that have been there 25, 30 years. And they were a minor, and somebody else wanted to have control of assets. And we've seen many times where, I know that there are some very caring family members, but they have conspired because they want to get their check, or they want to get them out the house, or anything. You know, so you need safeguards. As someone is just sending me a message, safeguards to prevent family members and providers from colluding together. So that's what some of the callers are saying about your comments. I have lines open. If 718, if you want to come in, you're line 315 or 970, you're zip code, and 202, your lines are open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. One of the things I'd like to talk about, so I have a question.
Go ahead.
One of the things I just want to talk about is some of the positive things that are being done. You know, you talked about the alternatives conference and, you know, some of the exciting things that we're doing. I think there's a lot of good things happening. That I know that it, sometimes when we're struggling with these issues, it seems like it's all negative. But I find that there are huge numbers of individuals out there who are in their local communities working and advocating and speaking out and having an impact. It's just, one of the fun things I've found with Facebook is just a chance to hear from all the people that are doing good things back in their community in terms of, you know, working for rights protection, even just doing things to support people. Today in Delaware County, I was a Facebook person was talking about how they baked up a bunch of baked goods and food and took it down to the local Consumer Survivor Center in Delaware and served food to people that were getting in out of this sub-zero weather. And, and that was completely peer-run. That's a completely peer-run operation in Delaware. And the people they were bringing in the food were peers. And I think that's something that we need to do more to publicize is all the wonderful things that the people are doing in the peer-to-peer movement that, you know, unfortunately, as we're concentrated on these struggles that we have, we lose track of almost, you know. So I'd love to hear more about what other people are doing in their communities to kind of be a bright light, a shining light to help people and make a difference in people's life.
Okay, someone has just texted me and they said he was asked. The person he is asking about the Kennedy at Alternatives, and how did that work out? And has Kennedy become a supporter now, or is he still giving millions to brain research? Or do you know?
Kennedy came and spoke at the Alternatives Conference, and he spoke a lot about his own struggles and his family's struggles. Primarily, the story he told, as I remember it, is this is Patrick Kennedy. He's a former congressman from Rhode Island, and of course the son of Edward Kennedy, who is one of the brothers.
And he just gave from $5 million to Morehouse College. Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know about that, but I don't know how much money he gives. I think he raises money. For he believes he definitely talked about how his viewpoint, and mostly he talked about a lot about addiction and the problems with substance abuse issues and his family, and so he definitely comes from that, a lot of information and knowledge on that. So yeah, well, I would challenge people. Is there not something that doesn't, for example, trauma? I'm kind of fascinated by people who are anti-medical model but okay with the trauma model, because if you think about the trauma model, doesn't repeated and extensive trauma have an impact on our biology? Doesn't being mistreated and I consider myself a trauma survivor. Doesn't that eventually cause problems that are organic in nature? I know from my own experience with trauma that my brain, my being has been impacted by trauma. So I guess my feeling is that if we can research and understand the brain, which is a very complex organism, and have a better understanding of the brain, that it definitely can help people with all sorts of illnesses. So I'm not opposed to somebody giving money to brain research if that's what they feel is the important thing. I personally don't have any money to give to anybody, but the Kennedys do, I guess. But he spoke at Alternatives.
Yeah.
He did a good job. I don't know. You were there. What did you think of his speech? You guys, I saw you going up there getting a selfie with him, so I guess you weren't totally opposed to what he had to say.
I met him before he came and did a fundraiser here for something else that I was involved in. But, I just, for me, if I made that little statement that, you know, I know people that, that are standing in line trying to get voluntary services. They can't get them. And now you're going to be a proponent of...
It's not clear to me that he's supported the existing Murphy bill. My understanding, and I don't hang out with the Kennedys. I haven't been up.
He said his mother. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
My understanding.
Go ahead.
That's okay. My understanding is that what Mr. Kennedy did and proposed was that there'd be modifications, that there'd be things within the legislation, whether
it's,
that we make some compromises. And he worked toward trying to make compromise. I don't think he got very far with it, but I don't think he was blanketly out and out supporting the Murphy bill as it stands. And, I know there was a lot of excitement, and people got very upset about the fact that I think it's kind of a lot of prejudice towards the name Kennedy, because people have a lot of feelings about the Kennedy family, and I think that was one of the reasons people were sort of negative. But I thought he did a good job. If that person was wondering how it went, I thought it went very well. And we've continued to dialogue with some of the people that are involved with Mr. Kennedy.
I wish he had stayed around, maybe went to some of the workshops and got to know it, because this, a lot of things are negotiable. There's certain things like our rights, they're not negotiable. And
well,
he
stayed a lot longer than a lot of keynote speakers and listened. He stayed until every single person who had a question or a comment to make made them that night. And he was there for the whole for that whole hour and a half.
No, I'm talking about after his. And I understand he wasn't a keynote because there were other keynote people, but that he after we got up in the line and people made comments and asked some questions. I was talking about as being a participant at the conference itself. It's something different when you
that would have been great.
Fly if you fly when you fly in and you give a speech and you leave. It's different than when you hang around with the people. And I think his Bill Emmett did. I saw him around in one of the lounge areas talking to people. But you know, it's something different when you get a chance to talk to people and have give and take, and than when you just get up there and speak like that. But one of the other positions, I want to say this and get your comments on it before you have to go, is that the P&A, you know, some of the things that he has in the Murphy bill, for me, it's just like, I don't know if he just, if they're just saying it to, because he's gotten marching orders from the Treatment Advocacy Center, because it just seems like a lot of this stuff is just right out of Tory's playbook. I mean, the P&A, I know many people that who choose to get service. I know some people, you know, choose not to. They're, you know, completely out of the system altogether. But the only way they get what they need is because the disability rights or the P&A for their state goes in and fights for them. So I don't understand what the issue is about, unless he just wants the P&A not to tell people their rights about not being involved in treatment.
Well, again, you,
I don't know where
I
that's
think
coming.
You put your, yeah, I think you put your finger on it when you said that the orders is from the Treatment Advocacy Center. The Treatment Advocacy Center, for the people that don't know it, is a you know, product of basically one person's efforts, and that's a guy named E. Fuller Torrey, Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, who at one point was actually a very progressive psychiatrist, but something got to him, something happened to him, and he became very reactionary, kind of right-wing psychiatrist. And he...
money.
Well, I don't know. He's got passion that goes beyond money. I mean, he's unfortunately a very passionate, you know, advocate for the dark side, I'd say, you know, and his viewpoint is that rights, the issue of rights have swung too far, the pendulum of rights has swung too far, and it's lawyers, he's very anti-lawyer, like a lot of right-wing people are, you know, if you look at his rhetoric and his propaganda, it's very similar to a lot of libertarian right-wing type people, in that the problems we have in our society are lawyers. Not that people need their rights protected, and not that there's abuse and neglect, but that there's lawyers representing them, preventing that, you know. So he's very anti-lawyer, almost reactionary anti-lawyer approach, you know, anti-civil rights lawyer. So that's why, you know, and the Protection Advocacy Program pays for lawyers. And so, you know, that's why he wants to see it destroyed. And he's gotten Murphy to listen to him. And Murphy's pretty right-wing himself. But it didn't take much to convince Murphy. Murphy's historically and notoriously a very right-wing person, primarily responsive to the National Rifle Association, et cetera.
Yeah,
I hear a lot of pings out there.
They're saying Tory's sister was kept in a state hospital all of her life. I can't pronounce the guy's name, Szasz, S-Z-A-S-S-Z, is another example of a libertarian psychiatry. And that Tory is into Freud. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. So, he seems He's into, I don't know. He's into something. I don't know. I won't say any much more than that because I don't want to.
I don't know.
I don't want to get sued.
Everyone that when I go up there, it's like they become animated. Here I come to ask questions between myself and Diane Angster. It's almost like they become physically ill. They kind of twist around, and their body becomes animated. Like, you know, oh, what are they going to ask now? Well, actually, Tori's sister, someone else was saying that Tori's sister was in a group home. And I think that's a good point because some of the group homes are even more restricted than a hospital. I know people that told me if they had to go to a group home, they might as well stay in the hospital. I don't know if you have them in Pennsylvania, but we have over 1,000 people in contract beds and over 500 people in these group homes, and they make lots of money off of our peers. Okay. Anybody have any questions? Because Joe is going to have to go in a very few minutes, so if you're listening, and I'm getting the comments that you're enjoying this, but anybody in the 718-315-310-301 zip codes, if you have if you haven't pressed one, I've opened the lines up so that you can talk, or either you can I'm getting lots of PMs on Facebook and Twitter.
Hi, Yvonne, Joe.
Yes.
Hi,
it's Lauren. I couldn't resist. Hi, I hope all is good. Sounds great out there. Thank you both for getting on and doing this whole thing. So, Joe, I just can't help but resist, but I've got to say that, like, I don't disagree with what you're talking about Tori at all, in terms of him being behind the Treatment Advocacy Center and libertarian right-wing kind of stuff. The only thing I've got to say is that, like, he's also just entirely into fraud because SAS is another version of what libertarian psychiatry could look like. And so his promotion...
Are you saying
Freud
or fraud?
Synonymous, I suppose, right? No, I don't know. I mean, Freud, you know, the sellout failed to, you know, whatever, don't even get me started. But for Tori, fraud... And promoting the fraud of psychiatry, you know, SAS, you know, would say that, you know, slavery cannot be reformed, it must only be abolished, right? So that's another libertarian view to how psychiatry could be going. So I think that we need to hold Tory accountable for what he's doing with this right wing and stuff, but also very specifically for the fraud that he's promoting and the way
I
that
agree
that...
With you.
You know,
I
the way that
you.
Fraud is getting mixed into everything, even when you were talking about the trauma letter, like I'm screaming in my head, but not at you, but just like, because, you know, that's what they're saying. But that's the medicalization of, you know, abuse and trauma and torture and all kinds of horrid things that people have to be put through in that process of being abused. So... Like, we need to hold these people entirely responsible on the fraud that they're promoting and benefiting from, not only in terms of
just
money.
I want to say this because
I don't think it's only in terms of money. I think it's also in terms of notoriety, access, stature, public's perspective of him, the accolades that all of these people are getting, if not directly for money, that this other passion isn't necessarily, because I've gotten into it, you know, where they say to me, oh, so you'd rather have them, you know, die with their rights on, and it's like, you know, that the pendulum, like you said, the pendulum of rights has swung too far. Like, these people need to be held in check. They need to be held accountable for the bad science that they're putting out there. And I think with, you know, Whitaker and others, that there's so much work that's been done to show how it's a fraud that we need to not let them get away with it.
I hear you. I agree.
That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think we have any disagreement about the, as we say, the dark side. I just think that they just want us because I could right now that block grants and stamps will go away because the House doesn't have the authority to do. And I think you understand that Tim Murphy is over a subcommittee that is really over. And there's another committee called. Are you trying to talk? I don't know. There's another committee that's actually the Health Committee. And people need to watch that committee as well because just like the Doc Fix bill came in and gave the demonstration project on AOT, there could be something else. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, and thank you for doing the show.
Okay, great. And I wanted to, like I said, thank you very much, and I want you to feel free to come back again. I think that you've given clarity to what people can do as far as advocating, and I think that people should go to tracker.gov and other places to keep on top of the legislation and develop a relationship with your congressperson. If you're a congressman, especially if he's on the Energy and Commerce Committee or the Health Committee, Health Subcommittee, is to find out what staffer covers that issue and do that now. Don't wait until some emergency bill so they have a relationship with you. And just like that, people will call you and ask your opinion because they know who put them in that chair.
Thank you very much. Great advice.
Okay, and people can stay on the line. We'll stay on at least for a little bit longer to see if anybody has any other comments or questions. Okay?
Goodbye. Goodbye. Have a good night, then. I'll talk to you all later.
Good night, Joseph. Okay, I'm open at the lines. If anybody has any announcements or comments or anything, they should do that now. Or if they just want to talk about anything, feel free to do that. To come on, I want to say that next Sunday night, I will have George Ebert from New York. He will be on, another one of our heroes. And he was an early founding member of the Patients Liberation Front. March the 6th, I will have Chris Hansen, who works in intentional peer support. She and Sherry Mead developed that peer counseling program. They will be on as well. And I don't have a set date yet, but Tracy Love is going to be coming on from California sometime in between that time as well. Okay, and someone's asking me why did I have Joseph leave early. I didn't. I stayed on longer than what he wanted to. He didn't realize the show was for 2 hours, and he stayed longer than what he intended to stay. So I was not forcing him off the line. That was the time that he gave me. And I have, all during this time, have access to people's my Facebook and Twitter. So he was telling me that he had to go, and it ended up being on a little bit longer than that. So I was not cutting him off. He just had to go. I know that there are some grant proposals. He did not say this, but I know there's some proposals that are in the mix right now that people are working on because another person from one of the other technical centers who I had invited on said that they couldn't do it because they were in the mix of... Hello? They were in the midst of doing the proposal for the Consumer Technical Center. So I don't know when that's due, but there seems to be a couple of things that people may be working on. He didn't say that for himself, but I was told that after this proposal was over with that I would be able to get someone from Pure Links on, which I had wanted to have them on with Joseph to talk about alternatives. Again, if you're listening by blog radio, all of these shows are archived. If you wish to call in and you just can't do that through blog radio, you can call 267-521-0167. Again, that's 267-521-0167. And you can, of course, follow the link, and you can, all the shows are archived. In fact, many more people listen to the show after airtime. We have, hundreds of people sometimes that listen to it either through blog or through podcast. So one of the shows that I've talked about being in the future, you're not able to listen to, you can go ahead and later on listen to it after the air date. Okay, unless someone comes in, I think I will end the show for the night. It's been great. It's been wonderful. I will hope to be online and on the air to next Sunday at 8 o'clock. Last call. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Have a good night. Yes? Someone have to. Someone trying to say something?
Hello?
Yes, you there?
I am here, Yvonne.
Yes, who is this?
This is George Ebert.
Yes, George. George is the guest who's going to be on next week. You can talk now if you like on anything as well. I look forward to
Did you get my bio?
Yes, I did get your bio.
Okay, well, I serve as an advocate and activist with the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance.
Okay, I'm sorry. Front, I said. I apologize. I will have it correctly. What did you think of the show tonight? Did you listen in, or were you?
I listened into both of it. The computer kept kicking out, so I went to the phone and back and forth a couple times.
Okay, well,
I think, now.
Want to say something you can before I end the show. Or if you
right, well,
like
I think
to continue,
Joseph Rogers did a good job. It was good to hear him. And mm-hmm. I'm hoping I get some callers and questions and comments when I'm on next week.
Okay, well, I look forward to seeing you and that, I'm not seeing you, I mean hearing you online. I'm going to end the episode now, and have a good night, everyone.